called The Rule of Three. Tim Slagle over here. On the other side, we got Brian Miller.
Hello.
And new bumper music. We have a new intro there that's courtesy of Stone Bogart.
Great name. Stone Bogart.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite bands that is no longer a band.
That is Stone Bogart, not Stoned Bogart, correct?
No, there is no D on it. That is correct.
It's a different, different connotation entirely.
So anyway, I'm sitting around the house. We had a little bit of rain. I don't know how the weather's been up there.
Yeah, a little rain, a lot of we had like a windstorm today that was just unbelievable. I woke up, I was like, great, I bought a house and a week later it's going to blow over. Fantastic. Perfect timing.
Well, you know, as long as the insurance is paid.
That's true. It's like the nightclub in Goodfellas, right?
However, the moving expenses and effort.
Yeah. At this point, I would live in the smoldering crater for a year if this place burned down.
Actually, yeah, we were supposed to talk about that last week. We never got around to it. We were supposed to mention last week that you had just moved into a new house.
Yes, the big move. The house that I own as opposed to a house that I am borrowing from a person who likes to take a lot more money from me than they should. So so far, somebody asked me what the difference was between your new homeowner, how's it feel? I was like, oh, it's really no different. I'm still living in a house I like, but I have a real crappy landlord who doesn't know how to fix anything.
Yeah. Dang, that light bulb burned out. Who do I call?
Yeah, right. That's so far, it's been about the same.
I've been here at my place for a number of years. And one thing that I've been fighting, and I thought I conquered it last year. I thought I had finally won the Battle of the Ants.
Great movie from 1958.
The Battle of the Ants? You just made that up.
Yeah, no, it might actually be. There's probably a 20% chance it's a real movie from 1950-something, but yeah.
Well, yeah, well, there is a movie from 1950-something, but it was called Them.
Them. Oh, I've seen. Oh, yeah. Them is great. I own that on VHS. So, true story.
So that would be, but no, it's not like that. It's just these pesky little buggers that you know, you think you've gotten rid of them because you haven't seen them for a while, and then it takes like a real good rain, and all of a sudden the counter is just full of them. And they don't gross me out. They don't. You know, it's not like slugs. I mean, if it was an invasion of slugs,
yeah, that would be unfortunate.
That would be horribly disgusting. Or frogs. I can't remember. I can't imagine what it would be like to live through a rain of frogs.
I know exactly what it would be like, or almost exactly, because the worst gig I ever did in my life was in Missouri Valley, Iowa, with John Conroy, who you might know, good friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
And the town had some sort of biblical frog plague. They weren't falling from the sky, but like the ground was just boiling with frogs. Everywhere you looked, it looked like the grass was moving and popping. And there were these little frogs, big frogs, everywhere. I mean, when you walked, you would just feel them squash under your feet. And we were at this – it was an interstate bar, and there was a hotel next to it. And you had to walk across this field to get back to the hotel. We were just walking through, and these frogs were bouncing off our legs. And when you would open your door to the hotel, the frogs would rush in to get in toward the light. And so before I went to bed, I had to get my notebook and use it like a bucket, and I was just flipping frogs out the open window.
You stayed?
Yeah, we were really far away, and there was nothing nearby.
I don't think I would stay in that town. I've seen those movies. That's usually the sign of something worse about to happen.
That's true. Well, nothing could be worse than the gig that we just endured. I mean, it was truly the worst show of my life. That was a bunch of bikers from Philadelphia happened to be stopping by what turned out to be kind of a, let's call it, clannish bar. There was definitely some racial overtones that were unpleasant. And one of the bikers runs up to me and bends over and drops his pants and moons me and starts waving his ass at me and says, "Come and get it, big boy," about 10 minutes into my set. And then I made some joke about, well, maybe later, but I got to finish this show. And then he, like a light switch flipped, he became very serious and he pulled his pants up with the utmost dignity and said, "Are you a homo?" And I was like, I'm going to get beaten to death.
I mean, it was you are the one who presented.
Yes, literally presented. Literally. That was one of the few times I was wise enough to not continue wisecracking. Got threatened by a guy with a bunch of prison tats because I, quote, looked at his girlfriend while I was on stage. They were in the front row, so he's not wrong. I did look at the audience I was facing.
So I got some
experience with the frogs, which is but luckily they weren't in my house.
But the ants, they just make me itchy to look at them. They just make me itch.
You know, one ant is just like, if you see one ant, to me, I'm just like, hey, little fella, go on your way. You know, but when they team, you get 20 or 30 of them and they're all moving at the same time. Ugh.
Yeah, the trouble is, nothing works anymore. They have become resistant to all the chemicals that I have thrown at them. It's like there's this syrup that you get and you put mm-hmm. on little cards.
Yep.
And you put a little drop and they come and get it. And the idea is they're supposed to take it back and feed it to their children, and it's a slow acting poison.
Yeah, it's the same basic premise with American television.
But it does not seem to be working. All it does now is it makes them gather in one spot so I can follow the line and see where they're coming from. And then I can hit them with the big chemicals. But the chemicals I had did nothing.
Wow.
And then so I went out and I bought a new brand and it did nothing. And now I don't know what to do.
Antibiotic resistant ants.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think it's over 17 years of fighting them. I have bred a colony of super ants.
The super bug. That's what they call it when the antibiotics do, right?
Yeah. They're resistant to everything I can throw at them. So I have no idea what to throw at them next.
Well, you know, you could think of it from a negative perspective, in that you own a home that is being invaded by bugs from outside that you can't stop. Or you could look at it like you are the greatest ant coach of all time. You're like the Mickey of ants. They started off weak. They couldn't even run up the stairs. They're like, come on, Rock. Eat the syrup, Rock.
And now if I can just train them.
Ooh, like Willard. Isn't that the movie Willard, the kid with the rats?
If I can just train them. And it's, you know, and it's... train them to, you know, like steal cars and stuff.
They could all just get under the car and the car would just sort of slowly move away.
Or maybe just disassemble, you know, like teach them how to pull off the catalytic converter.
It'd be like a swarm of ants just go over the car, and then when they leave, there's just individual parts all laying around there. We've seen the Bugs Bunny cartoon version of it. And when you see all the ants walking, they definitely don't you? I know I can't, but in my mind, I can hear all their little legs moving, and it sounds like, you know, like a little jangly noise.
So I don't know what. So how about you? You said that you might have that your new place.
Well, we had a false alarm. I hope the second day we woke, my wife woke me up with a very serious face, and she looked at me. She said, "The cats threw up twice last night." I said, okay. And she goes, I think they're just nervous. But also, there's a bunch of ants in the mudroom, and I already cleaned up the puke, so now you have to take care of the ants. Which I got the impression to mean my wife was freaked out by the ants and cleaned up the puke so as to not leave me with an option of which job to take.
So the ants went after the puke?
No, it was separate incidents, as it were.
Oh, okay.
The owner had done a very nice job of cleaning the house up, but she had a couple of dogs, and every now and then we found a couple of really random, like a dog toy stuffed into a far corner or whatever. And I think it must have been something her dogs dragged in, but there was some sort of orangish, sort of looked like a piece of sweet potato lying on the mudroom floor. But I never figured out what it was. It was covered in ants, and so I feared that it was a portent of ant invasions to come. I hurled the whole contraption out the window and or out the door. So far, the ants have not returned. But then I've only really laid the smackdown on them for like a couple days. So I 17 years it takes for them to. That's the ticking time.
Oh no! 17 years I've been fighting them. 17 years since I spotted the first one.
That's what I mean. So this was my first encounter. So I've gotten till 2033, And then so, you know, the moral of the story here is in 2031, I'm putting the house on the market.
And right now, we're at the end of the segment.
Put that on the market. And the big news of the week for the second segment here, this week, Muhammad Ali died, which was, I was thinking about this, it's both not news at all and massive news. It's a weird combination of the two, and I think that's why the story feels sort of simultaneously perfunctory and overwhelming.
You know, he was such a ham, you know, that he could not appear on television enough, that he genuinely enjoyed doing cameos and everything he could. So just the fact that you no longer saw him anymore was a sign that he was becoming quite ill.
Right, and it had been, I mean, that was the thing, and I haven't really heard anyone say this, but, I mean, it felt like he'd already died, kind of. I can't imagine how many people who saw that turned to their roommate and said, Muhammad Ali wasn't dead already?
Yeah, sadly.
Because he's been so in ill health for a long time.
It was assumed that he was no longer with us. So it was not a surprise, but it what it did, what I saw, it gave, you know, his passing gave the opportunity for everyone to remember him.
Yeah, exactly. And so in that way, it's sad that he died, of course. But overall, I think the story, that there was mostly a very positive connotation. I mean, you got to see that in the final judgment, as it were, at least in the final earthly judgment, depending on your persuasion, he came out pretty well. You know, it was a lot of people from a lot of different sectors remembering him well for a lot of different reasons.
Right. From his it was kind of funny. I was watching the ABC documentary, ABC News documentary on it, which there's no way they could have produced that in the short amount of time. That
oh, they had that thing. Oh yeah, they had that. I mean, they figure like, well, if he happens to have one other like heartwarming encounter in his super old age, we'll just tack that in the last 30 seconds
was,
and trim it down.
There was an
episode
of Mary Tyler Moore like that. Don't know if you ever saw it. Remember it? It's the gist.
Don't remember the episode.
Is that Mary has to stay late and update all the standard obituaries. Yeah, she has to go through the whole file and cabinet and make sure that everything's up to date, adding the little heartwarming tags to making sure that they're current. And by the time they get to Wee Willie Williams, happened at the time to be the oldest man in Minneapolis. They were both kind of goofy, and Rhoda actually wrote it, and one of the things was if he has the time, he'd like to spend some time gardening, traveling, and breathing. And they typed it up, put it in the file, and went home. Mary slept in because they were up all night, and by the time she comes in, the news that Wee Willie Williams had died, and Ted grabbed the obituary from the filing cabinet.
I genuinely, when I was a newspaper editor, had serious fears about stuff like that happening. I always told the staff, I was like, no one ever type a joke into a story to amuse me, because never underestimate the fact that I might not be reading your work very closely. Like, you got a joke, you say it to my face.
So ABC. But I did notice that ABC liked to they were showing their hippie side. They liked to mention mostly his refusal to serve in Vietnam was for them, and the fact that he was actually I don't know what you would call it back then. He wasn't really a militant racial warrior, but I mean, it's, he wasn't like a Black Panther, but he was definitely definitely part of the Black Power movement at the time. And
for sure, I mean, you almost had to be when you're the most powerful Black guy. Right? How could he not be? He's the most powerful guy.
That stuff kind of faded to as he got older. As he matured, he kind of put his radicalism away. It's the big change from the name Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali was controversial, and it was interesting. I saw an interview where he said that Cassius Clay is his slave name, and I also, somebody posted who Cassius Clay was. And did you know Cassius Clay was was a prominent abolitionist from Kentucky? And which
Makes sense.
And I would like to.
It
was actually, his dad was named after him, and he was named after his dad. But I would like to point out abolitionist from Kentucky.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
that's a tough
one. So the guy was the guy himself was a fighter, to say that he had that name was a slave name was kind of ignoring the true history of his name.
Yeah, abolitionist from Kentucky, by the way, is like being the point guard for the Lollipop Guild. Yeah, no, it was interesting to see which – some of the networks were, like, certainly more eager to talk about the Vietnam stuff than the racial stuff. I think you could see what people were – Ali was, in a lot of ways, a litmus test for people. You know, it's like the networks, like the old hippies have decided that the Vietnam stuff is like, well, that's a very safe thing to talk about now, you know. But, like, with the Black Lives Matter going on, they don't maybe want to tangle with the racial politics quite as much, or the people who just want to talk about it from the sporting angle, or you know, the Nation of Islam, because
I think I've seen him with a bow tie. I think he was.
But I mean, he's a spoke on the wheel of culture in a way, don't you think? I mean, think of so many different things, you know, events and ideas and movements all intersected through Ali. You know, he was kind of like there's 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon in the movie. You can kind of do that with Ali in just the world.
People are talking about, you know, that he was Muslim. They're saying, well, he was an ambassador to the Muslim faith, and I don't know if that's really accurate, because when people think of the Muslim faith, they think of it more from its origins. You know, it's not a convert really isn't an ambassador to the faith. You know, you don't think you don't think of Sammy Davis Jr.
as an ambassador
to Israel. No, not at all.
Oh, that's a perfect example. Yeah, although, I mean, just in terms of sheer brand recognition, throwing the word Muhammad up there like that certainly was a step. But yeah, and then it's interesting that you really could divest all discussion. You could completely table all the politics stuff and talk about him just as an athlete, and it still wouldn't. Would not be overhyped. I mean, in terms of both his ability at his sport. Because, you know, I think now people are like, oh, he was the boxing champ, and it sounds cool, but that was back when boxing was a big deal sport. I mean, boxing now is not – boxing now is a secondary sport at best, wouldn't you say?
I think a lot of people – I think a lot of young people come up to don't understand that it's actually a real sport. I think a lot of people come up probably lump it in with professional wrestling.
Well, and you know what's interesting? There's – it's such a simple reason. Football is the most popular sport in America, and boxing is one of the least. And football made sure that all of their games were on network television for free every Sunday and Monday, and boxing switched to a pay-per-view model.
Huh.
There you go. I mean, it's just that's why boxing dropped off. You could never get, because you couldn't get entry level. And now, if you told me now Would I pay $10 a game to watch the Vikings? Absolutely, I would. I would pay that every Sunday. But would I have gotten into the Vikings enough to want to pay $10 a game to watch the Vikings?
No, you're right. That's I would not. That is an excellent point. That no other sport actually went that way. That I just lost my train of thought there.
Well, and Ali never could have been as prominent.
I know what I was going to say. I know
as a boxer,
I was going to
say
that when boxing was at its biggest was when they were looking for stuff to put on television. And,
yes,
and boxing
absolutely.
Was a great live drama. They had the cameras were so big and clunky. You couldn't do a Big Brother or a Survivor. There would be no ability to do a show like that, a reality show in those days.
Or football even. I mean, you watch old football footage. Now you're used to the camera zipping in and zooming in. But, you know, you could just show the field from far away and the action was kind of small. But boxing, because it was confined to that ring, you know, you just hone the camera on that ring and there you go.
Yeah,
two guys fighting.
The stage is set.
So it's interesting. So then, you know, its intersection with the media kind of diminished the sport ultimately, but then Ali himself was a master of the media.
And,
and
he will be missed.
He will, yeah. Amazing, amazing guy, and definitely worth rewatching old footage of him and fights and all. Yeah.
Definitely listen. Worth sticking around for the next segment. Yeah. And that bumper was provided by Snake Out, thanks to the good people of Speed Cult for providing that for us. It's Snake Out, another defunct band, but now Speed Cult makes some of the finest metal in Detroit. So
what you're saying here, I think, is that if you're in a really good band, don't become friends with Slagle.
Yeah.
You're like the Typhoid Mary of bands.
Way, doesn't it? we decided to mix up the bumpers here a bit. So if there's any listeners out there that are in a band and want to get airplay, just drop us an email and we'll be more than happy to stick you in between the segments. But today I was going through Facebook and a friend of mine had posted an article that really grabbed my attention, and it was written by Groucho Marx's grandson.
He doesn't have a funny name. That was the sad part. I was really hoping his grandson would be named, like, you know, Levo or Nito.
Spano. So, apparently, he is taking the credit for saving and archiving the You Bet Your Life series. And it's kind of an interesting story. It's a little glimpse into a Hollywood gone. Is that he would go to his grandfather's house for lunch every week, which, you know, when I read that at first, it kind of made me feel guilty that I never had that kind of commitment with my grandparents. And then he goes on to say that lunch with Groucho was always unique because he was celebrities would always drop by, that he met Alice Cooper and other celebrities while he was there. And in this particular lunch, he was having lunch with Marcel Marceau, Elliot Gould, and Jack Nicholson.
It sounds like a Bill Maher's dream politically incorrect episode from 1972. Yeah,
except for Marcel Marceau.
He could make some very expressive, demonstrative points,
though. Can you mime national health care?
If anybody could, he could. He wouldn't you say, by the way, Marcel Marceau, the only famous mime?
Only famous modern mime. Because
sure.
In the silent film era,
we
just did not call
them
mimes.
Era, yeah.
We called them blockbusters. We called them huge stars. We called them, you know, and it wasn't until the 70s that the art of mime was revived with Marcel Marceau. And he was huge for about 5 minutes. He was huge about as long as disco, I think. And spawned millions of imitators, and that gave mime a bad name.
That used to happen more in the 70s. I think maybe the internet era diffuses it, you know, where weird little niche things can always kind of exist, and they might get a little bump in popularity here or there, but they're always on like a wave frequency. But like, you look at the 70s, and there would just be trends. For like 6 months, everybody in the world would wear a leather fedora, and then just they would all simultaneously stop, and you could never find a leather fedora again. You know, the pet rock, mime, disco, there were all these things that had these very definite beginnings and endings, you know, the slamming shut of a door. Yeah, Richard Simmons. There were so many things. Like, there'd be some cultural topic, you know, and it's like, oh, they're going to make movies about fighting dogs this year, and there's going to be a bunch of those. Or, oh, there's a movie about race cars that turn into people or whatever, you know, and whatever it is, you got a year of it,
spawned, and this is, I can name another mime, a mime team. I can name Shields and Yarnell. They were the Donnie and Marie of mime, and they actually...
Shields and Yarnell sounds like they should make some sort of pill that my grandfather needs.
Or add another Yarnell, and it's a law firm.
Yeah, Shields, Yarnell. Have you been injured in a personal accident that didn't
Shields
look like it was anybody's
Yarnell
fault?
Actually had a variety show. It was because the 70s was also the era of the variety show. Yeah, you, there were many that have been forgotten. The Hudson Brothers had a variety show.
Yeah, well, you know, as we were talking about with Muhammad Ali and about them needing to fill airtime with boxing, you know, shows like You Bet Your Life and these variety shows, in a lot of ways, I mean, they're these very loose, chatty shows were really just filler, right? The guys talking. It was a cheap way to fill time on TV.
Yeah, no, that's true. The long,
I mean, some of it was great.
Don't
you think the talk show? I mean, I say this as a guy who tries to get on talk shows, but the hour-long talk show with the monologue and the celebrity interview feels kind of weirdly – it feels weird in the modern era because it feels like you're trying to stretch something out when now everything's about compression.
Yeah, I don't know if the late-night talk show can survive. I mean, there was just a whole turnover in late-night talk just this year. And we're pretty much the old guard, pretty much all packed it up and split, and all these young bucks are trying to redefine the talk show, and having moderate success, but you're right, it still feels like they're in a format that they don't want to be. You know, that they're trapped inside, that they were, it's almost a Twilight Zone. They woke up in an era where they did not belong.
Yeah, and I mean, this could maybe be the last wave, you think, of the last generation.
Well, it's
of
the
talk
last
show
hosts. Generation. The thing
on
is, it's the last generation of TV on time.
Yes, because the talk show is all about TV on time. I mean, you know, I don't think, like, the people still like comedy and they still want to hear famous people talk to other famous people and they still like sketches and music. So I don't think the talk show will like completely cease to exist, but it certainly might change formats to the point where it's, I mean, the format is the definitive part of the talk show.
Well,
really.
Well, in its slot, it was an ease down. It was an ease down from the nightly news. It's you know, before you went to bed, you'd click on the evening news, and then you would go into the talk show, and then the talk show you could leave at any time and not feel guilty, because the talk show was always weighted heavy on the front. There was never the talk show was never a tease.
No, you get to the big stuff first, and then you interview Truman Capote.
Right, then it trails
off. 12:55.
So it kind of knew that people were going to bed.
Yeah, I mean, SNL has always been formatted kind of that way, too. Hit them hard early, keep them as long as you can.
Well, you know, SNL, I think, was a different format. I think SNL has a lot to do, the success of SNL had a lot to do with people smoking bongs in college. It's Saturday night. It's late. It's what are we gonna do? Well, let's all gather around and smoke the bong and watch SNL. So yeah, so it does trail. It does have a tendency to trail off, but you know, but that's you know about the third or fourth pass of the bong.
Well, that's the writer's room as well.
And, you know, one thing I've noticed about SNL is that everybody thinks that the SNL that was on the air when they were in college is the best.
Oh, yeah, it's very – and I would love to claim otherwise, but you know, there's a particular SNL of my youth that in my mind, well, that was when it was good, and then it was just kind of mediocre after that. Now I'm just being like every other square. But, you know, we're talking about like You Bet Your Life and The Tonight Show. You know, those shows were very much considered disposable, and if I'm not mistaken, there is no existent footage – or extant footage, I guess would be the word – of Johnny Carson's Tonight Show when it was in New York. All footage of those New York episodes has been lost.
Which brings us around to the original topic.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, good for
you. I definitely did that on purpose.
Good for you.
Little Groucho.
Is that the grandson was over Groucho's house and the phone rings and he picks it up and it's NBC. They're going to destroy all the films of You Bet Your Life. And He says, Grandpa, what do you want to do with these? And he goes, burn them. Just burn them. And he wasn't sure if he was being funny or serious. And he said, well, you know, like Grandpa, you know, I think that there's some value in these. And Jack Nicholson says, the kid's right, Groucho. He goes, those things are classics. And so they ended up saving them. There was like 5,000. Is that right?
Yeah, and the kid, 5,000 reels. And the kid archives them. The grandson archives them all too, which, I mean, talk about an undertaking. Fun, but also, you know, I mean, you must have watched 5 or 6 a day every day for a year.
Yeah. And Oh, no.
But that'd be pretty fun.
I would love that summer job.
Yeah, I hope one day to be forced in a post-apocalyptic society to archive Seinfeld. Just give me a notebook and a pen, and I'll just start at the beginning.
That's the other thing, is that again, that's something lost, because Seinfeld is already very archived with the internet.
Oh, yeah, and digitally in the ether in all these different ways. You know, you didn't have to... be there on
Google
the day to watch
a line that you remembered from Seinfeld and find the actual episode that had happened, the scenario, the other subplots.
Oh, I've done it. I want to watch that one with, well, the one where Kramer's at the bagel shop, you know, and you got to Google Kramer bagels right up. There you go. It's the Festivus episode.
And I think we're actually a little bit over.
Yeah, speaking of classics episode, another classic episode of Rule of Three in the can.
I wonder if someday our grandchildren will archive these.
I wonder if someday...
Jack Nicholson, who will still be alive, will say, no one ever liked that show anyway.
Groucho, use those to light your cigar.
But whatever. We'll be doing another one next week. TimSlegel.com. That's where all these episodes are.
Yep, BrianMillerComedy.com and Real Brian Miller at Twitter. And if you're in the Minneapolis-ish area, I will be at Acme June 14th to 18th, opening for I do not know yet, but I will be there in the middle. And I believe old Robert Burrell will be opening the show. So come on out to Acme.
That's a wrap.